Welcome to Smart Talk. I'm Scott Lamar. There are more than 2,500 municipalities in Pennsylvania. Local governments generate revenue through real estate taxes and earn income taxes, and sometimes a combination of taxes and fees that don't produce as much revenue as a real estate tax. There are 56 cities in Pennsylvania, most of which are designated as third-class cities because they have fewer than 250,000 people. The state's cities often feel restricted in how they can generate revenue and have been looking to the state for help. Joining us to talk about this issue today, Lancaster Mayor Deneen Sirachi. Mayor Sirachi, welcome to the program.
Good morning, Scott. I'm so glad to be with you.
Also, Republican State Senator Scott Martin of Lancaster County. He's chair of the Senate Local Government Committee. Senator Martin, good to have you on the program.
Hey, great to be back with you, Scott.
If you have a question or a comment, give us a call. 1-800-729-7532 is the number to call. You can send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. You can also leave a question or a comment on WITF's Facebook page on Twitter. We are at SmartTalkWITF. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532. Mayor Sirachi, let me start with you. You're the mayor of a city that is considered financially healthy, even though taxes have gone up several times over the past decade. What challenges do you face?
Well, thanks, Scott. And we've worked very hard to get to the place that we are now in terms of being financially steady, but we do not see our financial future as being sustainable. And this is not something new. This is something that Mayor Gray was tackling before I got here, and it's really endemic to the state laws that we operate within as a Class 3 city. And so while it seemingly looks like Lancaster is doing great, we have one tool in our toolbox that we can adjust based on our needs, and that is the real estate tax. And the other tool that we have in our toolbox is reducing expenses. And we have continued to reduce expenses and also raise taxes over the last decade.
Now, I noticed that you hesitated when you used the word steady. Like you've had to think about this, whether, okay, are we steady, are we stable, or just what? But how did you get to a point where you are steady, considering that you do have limitations?
Well, I think that one of the things that I have benefited from as mayor has been very wise decision-making in the past. We have stayed very focused on our core services. We have not strayed beyond police, fire, water, sewer, stormwater, stormwater is the relatively new thing that has been added to our plate. We have also been very focused on attracting private capital into the city. A lot of people look around the city and think that all of that private investment that is happening in the city is really, filling our coffers, and that is not the case. The only thing that is generated out of that private investment are increases in real estate taxes. And those real estate taxes have not been dramatic because of property reassessment. So over the last decade, we have only seen just over a 1% increase in the total taxable assessed value. So 1.35%. And when you come to Lancaster and if you were here in early 2000s and then you look at where we are now, it's dramatic. Our downtown is dramatically improved. And that is not generating revenues that are able to offset the very modest increases in expenses year over year, which amount to between 2 and 3%.
I know it's difficult for you to explain why the city's properties were assessed at what they are, but why do you think they were assessed that reassessment really didn't help you?
Well, no, reassessment, well, first of all, there was a big big gap in years between, and Senator Martin, as a former county commissioner, can speak to this better than I can, but there was a decision that was made to postpone that reassessment. And so when the reassessment did happen, property values went up dramatically, but the thing that happens is that people also go to the county tax appeal board and have their assessments reduced for whatever reason. And so there's this constant fluctuation of assessed values going up and then also going down. And that has, over time, meant that the bar chart is just is very flat.
Mm. So, as you mentioned earlier, you have a limited revenue or toolbox, as you said, to provide revenue to the city. But you do have expenses, and that is constantly those expenses continue to rise in comparison to you know, the money that it, that is coming in. What have you done to cut expenses?
So one of the major things that we have done, which is very significant, was becoming self-insured. And our medical expenses have increased an average of 3.5% between 2012 and 2018, compared to a national average of 6%. We've refinanced bonds for cost savings of about $12 million in the last decade. We've reduced future post-retirement benefits that have to do with retiree health care benefits and so on. So these are for employees coming on into the system now. We've held the line on spending. You know, as I said, our expenses are between 2 and 3% increase year over year, in contrast to our revenues, which are only increasing 1%. And that difference between 3% increase in revenue or in expenses and 1% in revenues is our structural deficit, and it's something that we're tackling every year through this combination of reducing expenses and looking for ways to increase our expenses.
And
so that's the juggernaut we're tackling.
And I'm assuming that Lancaster's expenses are much like any other city, and really almost any other government today, municipal government.
Actually, they're lower.
Oh, okay. Well, I was going to say what I was going to say is your biggest expense is personnel.
Yes, and it's public safety. And just to as a point of reference, our real estate taxes generate $30 million. Our police and fire expenses in 2019 are $36 million. Just to put a pin in it.
Mm. And when we talk about personnel expenses, okay, public safety obviously is one of the priorities, if not the priority for a city government. But when we talk about personnel expenses, you have to include pensions in there and those retirement benefits that you talked about.
Yes, and we are precluded from making any changes. I mean, there's been a lot of conversation in the state about pension reform, and there's not a thing we can do about pension reform without help from Harrisburg. In the meantime, we've been paying it forward and thinking about how we can reduce these costs, the cost burden in the future, while also ensuring that we are caring for the people who have served our city.
Mm. And that is the bottom line, that and what cities are asking for is that you need help. What the laws that have been made, the rules, the regulations have been made that limit what cities can do have been made by the state legislature. Senator Martin, this is an issue that has been discussed for years, but yet very little seems to happen. Why?
Well, first, I think the mayor laid it out perfectly, the dynamic that's being faced, and I know when a lot of my colleagues here that what's known as the shining star of third-class cities in Lancaster is running into financial difficulty. I think it does raise some ears. We had a hearing down here recently in July talking about the health of third-class cities. I thought the mayor did an outstanding job of laying out the numbers and how long we have until things are really upside down. I think the biggest problem that you have in Harrisburg is a lot of legislators, and I don't mean this as a personal slight, learning how the inner workings and all the things that local governments are faced with, a lot of them have not been exposed to before. But probably even bigger than that, and this is through firsthand experience in pushing for reforms when I was a commissioner, is that on most of these reforms, there are special interests that also are fighting against changing the way things are. We have had that in the property tax debate through the years. When you talk about reforming the collective bargaining system, which has a huge impact on cities or any municipality, especially if they have the ability to be handed an award down by an unelected arbitrator. So there's things like that, municipal pension reform. I can tell you when we had a joint hearing of local government committees, I believe it was last session. I know Representative Greiner here from Lancaster County was involved in that. It's amazing the hit pieces in terms of pushing back on changing the pension system by those who are actually in the system. So my hope is that by continuing to have the discussions on the local level, and quite frankly, the fact that Lancaster, again, as it is known, now looking and facing at potential difficulties, that we can actually get some action. And there's probably no bigger thing that we can do than to find an alternative revenue source for cities, especially these most of our cities are older, they're grown out, they don't have a lot of extra room to expand naturally their tax base that a lot of other municipalities will have. So, and the fact is that the clear driver of the bulk of their costs fall in public safety, which isn't just utilized by city residents. You know, cities tend to be hubs as well for employment. The number of folks on a daily basis who are downtown filling up our parking garages, working in buildings here who rely on the protection of police, rely on protection of fire, but you really don't capture that when they're down here in terms of having a way to generate revenue to help offset those costs. And so it's pertinent that we really need to find a different way, and we're currently working on different options that we can give them more tools in their toolbox.
I don't want to get this conversation off track, but Senator Martin, what you just described at the end is what an argument that many people have made over the years for regionalizing services. When there is a hub city that the municipalities around contribute to help to pay for some of those services, you know, I say many people, but outside the cities, that's not a very popular concept.
No, and it can be. It depends on what it is. For instance, you know, we have a lot of our surrounding municipalities in Lancaster County that already have their own police force. They're already paying for their own police force. And so as the mayor, I know she's aware, whenever there's some things when it comes to regionalization that it's not just the elected officials that push back from those municipalities. A lot of times it's the citizens who do. The bottom line is that, you know, we in Pennsylvania as a commonwealth, and you started off the program talking about 2,500 municipalities, you know, we got 67 counties, you know, getting everyone to cooperate isn't always the easiest thing to do. However, I will also say that we're seeing great examples over the years. I know the mayor talked about going self-funded. I'm not sure if they're a part of a consortium or not, but I remember when we were at the county, you know, we combined with 21 other counties to do a self-funded consortium. We had joined, I think we had one point joined up with, I believe it was 500 other government entities in buying electricity bulk for all our services. So there are some good examples, equipment sharing, other service sharing. We do see them throughout the state. Joinders, so one county is providing, let's say, children and youth services to two different counties. So, but we need a lot more of it. But most importantly, when you talk about municipal mergers, you talk about even merging school districts, I'm sure you're aware of the real pushback that comes from our communities across the Commonwealth. So if we're not going to be able to do it from that perspective, then we absolutely have to give the tools necessary for, you know, our cores of our counties, which are our cities, so that they're able to be sustainable.
You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. Welcome back to Smart Talk. Now, Smart Talk takes a road trip to the Midtown Scholar Bookstore in Harrisburg, where we we will talk with Pulitzer Prize-winning author and historian Eric Foner this Friday. His latest book is about how the Constitution was amended after the Civil War. We invite you to join us as well. That's this Friday, starting at 9 o'clock. Go to WITF.org/events, and you can RSVP. But look forward to seeing out there. Always a lot of energy and an opportunity to hear from a Pulitzer Prize winner and someone as prestigious a historian as Eric Foner. That's this Friday at Midtown Scholar Bookstore in Harrisburg. It's part of their Harrisburg Book Festival. Today, we are talking in this portion of the program about the limitations that Pennsylvania cities face when it comes to revenue generation, how they provide for themselves, public safety, the personnel cost. Our guest, Republican State Senator Scott Martin of Lancaster County. He's chair of the Senate Local Government Committee, and Lancaster Mayor Deneen Sirachi. If you have a question or a comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. On Twitter, we are at smarttalkwitf. Again, the phone number, 1-800-729-7532. So Mayor Sirachi, Senator Martin laid out some of the options, but what would you, as mayor of the city of Lancaster, and have to say that Lancaster is in much better shape financially than a lot of other cities. I mean, there have been 20 cities, over 20 cities in this state that have gone into Act 47 for financially distressed cities. So what would you and other city leaders like to see from the state?
Well, here's the thing, Scott. Act 47 is essentially municipal bankruptcy. And when you enter into Act 47, you have access to tools that other cities do not have. And there's no prevention program to help cities avoid Act 47. And, you know, this is not to say that the city is on the brink of municipal bankruptcy. But I can tell you that if we do nothing else, and this is a big if, the economy holds strong for the next 5 years, we're looking at a $20 million deficit. And that number is alarming and means that we have to continue to hold the line in terms of our costs while we also look for ways to generate more revenue. And so two things here. You know, we've increased property taxes 8 out of the last 14 years, in large part because that is the only tool in our toolbox. And so I want to take you back to the year of 1965. Which is the year that the Local Tax Enabling Act was passed. And this allowed Class 3 cities 10 different ways to generate revenues in addition to real estate taxes. And the city collects 4. And those 4 are memorialized in state law at this time. And so what that means is that we really only have real estate tax as something that we can set to increase revenues. The other 3 taxes are all rates that are set by law, earned income, local services, and the real estate transfer tax. However, if you go into Act 47, you have some flexibility with the earned income tax and the local services tax to help reduce the burden, the sole burden on real estate taxes, and to have a less regressive tax mechanism. I have to say that this is not perfect by any stretch of the imagination. We do need real property tax reform and a very different way to fund cities that are regional assets, like Senator Martin was mentioning. We are a culture center, financial center, a healthcare center, a government center. We are serving Lancaster County and beyond through our employment here in the city of Lancaster. And we are not supported regionally. And so this where does this leave us? We literally looked at Act 47, like what would it actually take for us to have access to these different revenue tools, and it is so bad. I mean, to get to Act 47 is very detrimental for the long term of a city. You don't go into Act 47 overnight, and you surely don't come out of it overnight. And that is not the path that we are on, and we would like to have access to the same tools as other cities and to basically be acknowledged for doing a good job in terms of being careful stewards of city resources, rather than failing and getting access to tools to help you get out of it.
And something else to mention about Act 47, as I had mentioned earlier, that there have been about 20 cities in this state that have gone into Act 47 for being financially distressed. Once you emerge from Act 47, which hasn't happened very often, the same problems still exist. You're still limited at that point. So, Senator Martin,
correct.
So what are the options? What are you looking at to try to help cities?
Well, first and foremost, I'll say that the four core big things I know for years local governments have been pushing for that we need to do to change the system. One was the property tax reform or revenue reform for our older municipalities, collective bargaining reform, pension reform, and prevailing wage reform. But as I listen to you talking about Act 47, I could not agree more. I think the mayor hit it right on the head. We tend to wait until municipalities enter into financial distress, and then we want to give them options and flexibility. Forever, at least that I can remember, the city of Pittsburgh, the city of Philadelphia have been given options well beyond what any of our other older cities have been able to utilize as part of their toolkits. And it can be very frustrating. As a matter of fact, one thing that did happen while we were here was the fact that I know in the city of Harrisburg, in dealing with their financial issues, was given special legislation to be able to have a triple LST tax, local services tax, in order to keep its head afloat. I think the mayor and I agree wholeheartedly on some of the solutions that need to occur. I think one that we could really start off with, if we're already giving it to a city of the third class in the city of Harrisburg in order to keep their head afloat, why can't we give the same kind of options to municipalities like the city of Lancaster, who are doing all the right things, yet the numbers still aren't going to add up over a period of time? I think that's where we need to start with, and it's a good foundation based off the work with a bill that was passed just about maybe a year and a half ago that we can utilize, not only for the city of Lancaster, but the Reddings of the world and the Eries of the world. We just have to keep giving them tools. I know there's been a big push over the years to give various economic development tools, but as clearly came up in our hearing, and I'm sure the mayor would agree with, that's all wonderful. It's a needed part of it. It makes our cities vibrant, but that is kind of like a small piece of the puzzle. It's the structural reforms that need to occur, and she's absolutely right. A lot of these things are completely out of their hands, and it's something that we as a commonwealth need to pass in order to give them more of those tools.
Let's take a phone call from Gary in Susquehanna Township. Gary, you're on the air.
Hi.
Hi.
I think this discussion is very important because municipalities do need to find ways to increase revenues as well as cut expenses. And I think one idea might be to amend the earned income tax law to allow taxing income from capital, like capital gains, interest, and dividends, which are currently not taxed under that law. I think most municipalities would see a significant increase in revenue by doing that, and that's something that state could do, which wouldn't involve taking their revenue and giving it to a municipality or a school district.
Mm-hmm. Gary, thank you very much for your call. Senator Martin, what about that?
There's always talks about looking at the base, and again, everything in Harrisburg is a numbers game. You have to have so many, you need 26 members of the Senate to vote for it. You obviously need to get a majority of the House and obviously get a governor to sign it. Historically, when you've looked at expanding the base for various forms of taxation, whether it's EIT, whether it's sales tax, you always have the same dynamic of those who want to change it and those who don't. And we have to get it to the point where you have enough individuals up there who are willing to go ahead and change that. my preference, whatever broadens it the most, actually is one of the fairest ways to do it, and spreads out the burden among over a greater number of people. To me, that's always something that we should be looking at. But it is part of the conversation. I know the local Lancaster County Tax Collection Bureau has come to me and talking about some of their concerns with the base of the earned income tax.
All right. So a couple reasons that there may be some opposition to what we're even talking about today. One is, Senator and Mayor Sriracha, you probably have heard this too, but I'm going to address it to Senator Martin, that anytime you're talking about expanding what can be taxed or ways to provide revenue, there are many people who see it as just a way to raise taxes, that they see higher taxes in the offing. Senator, what about that?
Well, you hit it right on the head, and there's probably the poster child for what you're talking about is obviously the property tax debate. You know, when we talk about replacing school property taxes, a lot of folks forget sometimes that they need to be replaced with something. And so the natural thing to do is looking at other taxing mechanisms like the sales tax or the personal income tax. And as part of the sales tax discussion, you're talking about expanding the base potentially, or even the raising of the tax and how it impacts certain industries. And quite frankly, recently there was a proposal, I think it was, I like to call him Colonel Frank Ryan, who put out a proposal for property tax reform that involved taxing retirement income, which we are one of the two states in the country that do not tax retirement income. And you can imagine what the pushback on that's been like.
I spoke with Representative Ryan. Yeah, there's been pushback, that's for sure.
Yeah, absolutely. So there's always, wherever you put a tax burden, it's going to impact somebody. You know, and so you're replacing something with something, and sometimes the people that you're now going to be taxing on in this mechanism are going to push back real hard as well, and that's what a lot of people in Harrisburg are, you know, reactive to. But in this case, I think we're kind of up against the wall. I think the clock is ticking. I think the mayor's right. It's not like we're going into municipal bankruptcy tomorrow, but, you know, I give her a lot of credit for raising the flags now that we're paying attention to this, that even the city of Lancaster and how it's known is faced with this, that we absolutely have to make structural changes to how we allow local governments to operate, or else we're going to have a bigger problem. And if the Lancaster city's having issues, then we probably can expect a lot of other third-class cities to potentially looking at Act 47 or municipal bankruptcy down the road.
Senator Martin, as a former county commissioner in Lancaster County, and Mayor Sriracha, I'm sure you're well aware of this as well, but when you talk about property tax reform, Senator, almost all the attention is on school property taxes. Part of the reason is that they're so much higher for the taxpayer than what they pay out in municipal taxes or on the county level. But, you know, I'll bet there are many people here in this state who don't realize that their property taxes are going to the municipalities as well as and the counties as well. And it's not just school taxes when you're talking about property tax reform. That has to be a part of an issue here, is that municipal governments are not thought of in the same way as school taxes are.
No, you hit it right on the head. That property tax bill is inclusive of county property taxes, municipal property taxes, and obviously you have your school district taxes. Though schools are the biggest chunk, it's what people tend to focus on the most. We have areas of the state where literally half of their property tax overall burden is on the county and municipal side. So, though the school property tax issue does not come through the local government committee, I know that looking at municipal options do. It's not going to be easy in how you structure it. I remember about maybe 8 years ago, Representative Seth Grove in York had literally put out a proposal to allow counties and municipalities to have options instead of just property taxes, and of course he faced his own pushback. But we have to do something, and I personally would love to see options given that best fit their local economy, because some places may not have the local economy to drive a sales tax. Some areas might have it better. Some can handle an EIT better. And you know what? There are places in this state, Scott, that really have no problem with their property taxes. You know, there's places, I mean this respectfully, they may have more deer than people in their county, you know. And it's when they look at you cross-eyed when you say, oh, well, these property tax burdens so bad. Not everyone feels that same pinch, and hence that's why it's such a geographically divided issue across the entire Commonwealth. It's not a political issue because it's all over the map in terms of Republicans, Democrats on the property tax debate. It's a geographical issue based on who feels the pinch of property taxes. And we feel that here, and obviously in this case, in this discussion, with an older municipality that is more grown out, they need more tools in their toolbox, so we have to get them options.
Mayor Ciraci, tax-exempt properties, what percentage? I mean, right off the bat, I think of Lancaster General Hospital, I think of Franklin and Marshall College, but what percentage of the properties in the city of Lancaster are tax-exempt?
30%, and the first two that you just named make payments in lieu of taxes, which we are deeply appreciative of. They are not legally required to do so, and they do it. And so when I talk with other mayors, it's a similar number. In some places, it's even higher.
Well, in Harrisburg, for example, where there's state government buildings,
Yes. I mean, even just thinking about Millersville, which I know is not a Class 3 city, but the majority of their borough is the university. And so it's very difficult when you just take 30% of property value right off the top.
Would you consider selling assets that the city has?
Assets meaning stormwater, water, things like that?
Yeah.
Okay, so nobody's going to want our stormwater.
not a good sales pitch, you know.
We have an EPA consent decree, and we are dealing with a combined sewer system, and that's not realistic. Although I know some communities who have sold off their sewer infrastructure, and you know, I've talked to one mayor who was considering looking into it. As it relates to water, I'm opposed to selling off a public asset that is so fundamental and core to the services that we provide. We provide water to the residents of the city of Lancaster and the surrounding municipalities. We have 130,000 customers. We are a regulated public utility in that regard, and it is, as I said, so core and so essential. And, you know, I really do take pause as I look at water rates in communities where they have sold their water to a private entity because the costs are higher.
Well, let me ask you this then. I mean, all these issues are interrelated. Yes, Lancaster is an older city, as are most of the third-class cities in this state. If you're limited in ways that you can provide revenue, what about the infrastructure down the road?
In terms of
paying
city
for
streets,
it.
For example?
Yeah. I mean, how do you keep up on your infrastructure?
Mm-hmm. Well, we have been very aggressive in doing as much maintenance, relining of water, sewer pipes, resurfacing streets, et cetera, making sure that we are working in conjunction with our utilities so that we're not paving and then they're digging it all up.
That's a good thing.
Probably know that we have... We were recently handed down a decision from the Pennsylvania Supreme Court. We were advocating for utilities to be able to compensate city taxpayers for costs that we incur related to the work that they're doing in the right of way. And in a unanimous decision, the state Supreme Court ruled that that would be interfering with the utility and their ability to basically become, as they viewed it, as redundant to the role of the utility commission for assigning fees to that kind of work. And so, you know, that's $500,000 a year, and that's a conservative estimate from about 5 or 7 years ago. And so we have really tried to think out of the box in terms of how do we fund infrastructure costs. I'll say that, you know, just on street repair, we utilize bond funds, which is not ideal to be able to be funding that kind of infrastructure.
Yeah. Let's take one more phone call. Rob is in Lancaster. Rob, you're on the air.
Hey, good morning, Janine and Scott. This is Rob Bigley. I'm really enjoying this conversation. And listen, one thing that I think would be helpful for all of us would be to hear you talk about how a region could actually share the cost of a third-class city. As a resident of Lancaster, I'm feeling a lot of that burden that you were talking about earlier, and just wondering what are some solutions that Lancaster County could share in the cost of running our city.
Mayor, Senator, who wants to take that one?
Well, I'll jump in with an existing tax. It's called the Local Services Tax. It is a flat rate of $52 a year, with $47 going to the city and $5 going to the school districts. Local Services Tax is paid to the municipality and the school district where one is employed. It is the only tax paid to the city by someone who lives outside of the city and works in the city. And it has never increased since its passage, and Senator Martin, you might be able to help me remember when it was first enacted. But that's $1 a week, and I believe the intention of that was to support infrastructure, public safety, and the like. That is woefully inadequate, and just by increasing that would be a way for people who are working in the city and who do not live in the city to help support this regional asset.
We had a question, Mayor, and if I could ask you for a kind of a quick answer since we're running out of time. One of our listeners said, since the city is doing well and there are more people working in the city, we're assuming that doesn't that mean there would be more tax revenue from that tax coming in?
Yes, that's true. But in order to address our structural deficit, we'd need an additional 21,000 people to work in the city every single year.
Ah. So, Senator Martin, what happens next on the state level that could provide some relief to Pennsylvania cities?
Well, a lot of it's some grassroots actions. I know the mayor's already met with the administration. She's doing a good job also meeting with some of my colleagues in the House and Senate and mobilizing people to make this a front burner issue. I think we have a roadmap to get started based on what we did for the city of Harrisburg less than a year ago or about a year ago. But it's just where it takes is action. And I think this discussion that you're having today and getting the word out about how local governments are facing some of these challenges is critical, and I appreciate it. But now it's time for us in Harrisburg to take some action on this.
You know, I've had several suggestions here from listeners about recreational cannabis, but that's an issue that's probably going to have to be taken up on the state level, and we'll be talking about that in the future. Senator Scott Martin of Lancaster County is chair of the Senate Local Government Committee, and Lancaster Mayor Janine Sirachi, thank both of you for being with us today.
Thank you, Scott.
You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. Listen, tomorrow on Smart Talk, we'll be talking about changing Pennsylvania's science curriculum in schools. You also can visit our website to get an outlook of conversations we're working on. Plus, you can leave a voicemail or voice memo question for one of our upcoming programs. More information is at WITF.org/smarttalk. Garth Stein's 2008 novel, The Art of Racing in the Rain, sold 6 million copies and spent 156 weeks on the New York Times bestsellers list. The Art of Racing in the Rain was also made into a major motion picture that was released this summer. The story is told by Enzo, the family dog who believes that he can be reincarnated in his life as a human, so he prepares for it by watching television. Enzo's human master is Denny Swift, a race car driver who marries, has a child, and experiences triumphs and tragedies along the way. Garth Stein appears on Thursday at McCormick Riverfront Library, 101 Walnut Street in Harrisburg. Garth Stein joins us on the program today. Mr. Stein, welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks for having me.
If you have a question or a comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. On Twitter, we are at smarttalkwitf. Again, the phone number, 1-800-729-7532. So, Garth Stein, I want to read you an email that I received this morning. I love, love, love the book and bawled my eyes out at the movie and am currently rereading the book. After 10 years years, that has to still make you feel pretty good that you have that kind of reaction on someone who reads the book and saw the movie this summer.
Yeah, you know, Enzo the dog, that's the dog's name, who's the star and the narrator of the book, Enzo, has certainly gone out there and touched a lot of people. You know, when I first wrote the book, I gave it to my wife to read. She's always my first reader, and she said, Enzo's going to go around the world. So I guess she was right again.
Well, yeah, it was, from what I understand, it was your wife who suggested the name Enzo as opposed to Pablo?
Juan Pablo, of course, for Juan Pablo Montoya. That's what my original idea. And my wife said, no, that's not acceptable. And so she suggested Enzo for after Enzo Ferrari, the great car manufacturer. Of course, I'm sure I'll run into quite a few Ferraris in Harrisburg.
So how this story came together is really fascinating. You had a background in racing, so I'm not going to divulge more than that. I won't give away what went into the story, but several aspects of your life go into the story. Tell us about the parts of your life and your experiences that contributed to the book.
Well, I think that a writer pulls from so many different places, and not always my own life. Sometimes I pull from the lives of friends and relatives around me, because a writer is ultimately a good thief, I think. So, you know, there are elements of truth in there. Obviously, the racing, which is what I was doing at the time when I was writing the book, not realizing I was doing research. You know, I think fundamentally this relationship that we have with our pets is something that's really important. The book is dedicated to Muggs, which was my childhood dog when I was growing up. And I think that we all have that kind of, those of us who are animal people do have this special place for our relationships with our dogs and cats and bearded dragons, if that happens to be your thing. So, you know, all these sorts of things come in. The character of Denny was really based on a friend of mine who was a semi-pro race car driver, who's always hustling for a spot behind the wheel, always working, had a day job and all that. So, you know, a lot of things come from the stew, that it, the barrel of aroma that is my life. I got that from the ad that I heard when I was waiting to come on your show.
Really?
Barrel of aroma.
I did hear that, yeah.
You refer to my car as a barrel of aroma. It's fascinating.
So do you have experiences today that you think to yourself, oh, that would make a good story?
You know, that's actually quite funny. This morning I was reading Joaquin Phoenix's interview in Vanity Fair, and he said to the interviewer, you're messing up my acting. Stop asking such questions. So, you know, I think in the arts you have to have a little bit of mystery to it, and sometimes that mystery is to, you know, the artist is steeped in that mystery as well. And I think, so I try not to be too reflective as I live my life, and yet I guess subconsciously I'm always tucking things away to say, oh, that's going to be a good scene one day.
Yeah. Well, I mean, when you were writing the Art of Racing in the Rain, I mean, were you thinking along those lines, or as you started writing the book, say, okay, these are memories I have or life experiences I have that, oh, that would probably go well with the story?
Not so much. It was weird. The first idea for the book came 10 years before I started writing it, when I saw a documentary film about Mongolia and dogs in Mongolia and they're being reincarnated as people in their next lifetime. And so these things sort of like get, their seeds get set, and then you water them, you know, unconsciously, and then they start to percolate. And one day, you know, you open up the door and there's a whole room of mushrooms and you say, whoa, this is actually pretty good. So it's really, again, that mystery thing is something that I believe mightily in.
So other than Enzo believing that he can be reincarnated as a human, what makes him unique? He's telling the story.
Yeah, Enzo is the ultimate fly on the wall in the book and in the movie as well. You know, everything is filtered through his eyes, and he's a very devoted and loyal friend and partner. And so you're either with us or against us. It's all black and white in his world. And so the in-laws, Denny, the main character, his in-laws become the evil twins. They're not just regular people doing, you know, maybe something of dubious, you know, moral, whatever the word is I'm looking for. But they become like the most evil people on the planet. And so, this sort of like the way that Enzo is so compelling, and we empathize with him immediately, and we want to believe anything that he believes. So suddenly we become his psyche, right? And whenever he makes an observation about the world around him, we're like, of course that's true. Even though we know probably humans are not evolved from dogs, as Enzo maintains, you know, we still think they could be, you know, maybe they are. So that's the kind of the fun of Enzo.
So, okay, I have to ask this because there seems to be a bit of a disagreement here on the breed. Enzo in the movie is a golden retriever. What is Enzo?
Well, in the book, I left it deliberately vague because I knew that people would want to populate Enzo with their own dogs, you know. So we're giving few details in the book. We know that Enzo's mother is a water dog. So he says that he's half water dog on his mother's side. And we're not quite sure who Enzo's sire is. He believes it's an Airedale that was on the farm because he thinks that's a very dignified and powerful breed. When they made the movie, you know, they have to suddenly put an actual dog in there. And so it kind of came together, and I'm going to be talking about this on Thursday. The movie came together, despite the fact that it took 10 years, it came together very quickly, believe it or not. And they needed a dog that was trained up and ready to go. And the ones that the two dogs that they found who played Enzo, were golden retrievers. That's not meant to be restrictive to golden retrievers. That's just, that's the actor, you know. When they do a remake, maybe it'll be a Mastiff or something. I don't know.
Is there a remake coming?
I don't think so.
Let's talk about the movie itself. As you said, I mean, it was a while in actually coming to the screen, but then once it started being made, it happened pretty quickly. But as the person who wrote the original story, what were your observations about a film being made out of your book?
Well, they sort of like keep me in a soundproof booth. And not really asking me a whole lot of questions because they don't want me to cost them money. You know what I'm saying? If I say, oh, no, I think all the houses should be red, then they suddenly have to paint the entire town red, and it just is a disaster. So it was very much fun to like be kind of peripherally involved. I live in Seattle. The film was shot mostly in Vancouver, B.C., so I got to go up to the set with my family. My mother wanted to see a movie set and all that, so if you look really closely, you can see me in the background of a pit stop. So, you know, it was a lot of fun to be involved. The actors are fabulous. Milo Ventimiglia is great. Amanda Seyfried is amazing as Eve. And, of course, the voice of Enzo is Kevin Costner, and how can you beat that?
That's when you're bringing some real star power to the film when you have Kevin Costner there. In your mind, I mean, you just described what it's like. Sounds like there was a lot of excitement surrounding it as a family. But, I mean, was there a time when you looked at it and said, this is my story being acted out in front of my eyes?
Yeah, that ramped up. I guess it peaked at the first time they let me see it, which was back in April. And I went down to L.A. to a screening. It was just me, and my number two son is in college down in L.A., so he met me at the studio, and the two of us were next to each other. And he later admitted to me how petrified I looked. I thought I was kind of holding myself pretty calm, but apparently I looked petrified. So it was weird to see that, I have to say. It's like, oh, right, that's my line. I wrote that. You know, people laughing when I go to the movie theater and I see people watching it, and then they all laugh at a line. And I'm like, yeah, I wrote that. That's my line.
You wanted to raise your hand and point that out, huh?
I mean, you're laughing because you think that he said that, but he didn't say that. I said that.
Now, I should mention, I think I gave the wrong address a little earlier. The Gluckstein event is held this Thursday, October 3rd, at the Market Square Presbyterian Church in Harrisburg. Free parking's available at 10 Market Street Garage. So what message, when you're here in Harrisburg on Thursday, what message do you want to get across to the audience?
Well, I think that there are many messages in the book. That's kind of the whole fun of it, is that the Enzo's, you know, zen of human life sort of thing. And there are a lot of things that we can carry forward. I think that, you know, one of the big messages for me is that this relationship that we have with our pets, with our animals, with our dogs specifically, because I'm a dog guy, it's so full of love, and it's also full of, it ends with grief always, right? We know what the ending of the story is going to be, but we still indulge in that relationship because it is so enriching for the 10, 12, 15 years that we are with our friends, right? So why is it so important? I think it's because we treat our dogs with unconditional love. And we don't have any expectations for their behavior, or we'll withhold our love from them. And yet with people around us, we do have these conditions. We treat all of our family and friends and spouses and siblings with all these, you need to act a certain way for me to love you. And I think that the big message for me of the book is we should all learn to treat each other more like dogs. In a good way. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I know what you mean. Garth Stein, again, will be at Market Square Presbyterian Church. Free parking available at 10 Market Square Garage. That's this Thursday, October 3rd. He's the author of the 2008 bestselling novel, The Art of Racing the Rain. Garth Stein, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thanks for having me.
You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News.